From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Clinton administration steps up military and economic aid to Colombia. Also, Turkey's multi-billion dollar military is slow to respond to a national disaster. And on the eve of East Timor's historic vote on self-determination, Indonesia deports Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman, who has exposed past atrocities in East Timor. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, sitting in temporarily for Amy Goodman. I'm Laura Flanders. First, these news headlines. Unions called for the biggest strike since apartheid, and thousands of public workers marched through the capital of South Africa today to challenge President Thabo Mbeki's new government over wage increases. 12 unions representing 800,000 teachers, nurses, prosecutors, and other public employees were staging the one-day strike, forcing many public offices to operate with skeleton staffs and keeping thousands of schoolchildren at home. The Federation of Unions of South Africa, 40% of whose 500,000 members are white, supported the strike along with the 2 million member Congress of South African Trade Unions, a predominantly black group. The snowballing labor actions threatened to tear apart a decades-old alliance between Mbeki's African National Congress, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and the Communist Party. While the trade unions group and the communists seek a socialist South Africa, the ANC is implementing free market economic policies and selling off state-run industries, they say, in hope of generating job growth and revenues. The ANC says it doesn't have the money to bend to the union's wage hike demands. Iraq claims the United Nations destroyed chemical weapons samples found at a Baghdad laboratory to cover up illegitimate activities by UN weapons inspectors. Traces of VX nerve gas and other agents were left behind when UN weapons inspectors pulled out of Iraq last December, and the issue became a flashpoint in the U.S. Security Council. Baghdad's allies wanted the tiny samples kept for more analysis, suggesting they may have been used by inspectors to taint Iraqi warhead fragments. The U.S. found that those fragments contained traces of chemicals. Iraq admits it produced nearly 4 tons of VX, but denies loading it into missile warheads. Students opposing a 4-month-old strike of Mexico's main university fought with striking students yesterday, leaving several people injured. The clash at the university occurred when hundreds of protesters opposing the strike tried to enter the National Autonomous University in Mexico. The government news agency Notimex reported that striking students who have occupied the university since April 20th tried to stop them. Shouting and shoving ensued, and large firecrackers were thrown. Students began the strike to protest plans to raise yearly tuition from a symbolic 2 cents to $145. The university backed down on the tuition increase, but students continued the strike to press other demands, including greater student control over how the university is run. The news from Yugoslavia: there may be some movement soon in a standoff between Russian soldiers and ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. A Dutch official says he hopes Dutch and Russian officers can meet with ethnic Albanian leaders today to resolve the standoff. Since yesterday, Albanian citizens have been blocking Russian troops from entering a town in southern Kosovo. The peacekeepers are there to take over for their Dutch counterparts, but ethnic Albanian protesters fear the Russians will side with the Serb paramilitaries. One organizer says a delegation has gone to Kosovo's capital to deliver a letter to UN and NATO officials demanding that the Russians leave. Russian officials say that they're convinced their NATO partners will eventually overcome the resistance to their presence. An inmate beaten to death with a laundry bag full of rocks is the fourth to die at New Mexico prisons run by a private company. Orlando Gabaldon, 51 years old, was watching television Sunday when he was attacked, state police said. He'd been serving a life sentence at Guadalupe County Correctional Facility for habitual armed robbery. The 600-bed prison is run by Wackenhut Corrections Corporation. The company has a $25 million annual contract to hold about 1,500 inmates at two prisons in New Mexico. About 30% of New Mexico's 4,720 male inmates are in privately run prisons like Wackenhut's, some of which have been hit by outbreaks of violence. A Jewish in Mississippi has won a battle to wear a Star of David necklace to school. The school board in Harrison County has exempted religious symbols from a policy barring students from wearing anything that could be seen as a gang symbol. Yesterday's decision came a week after the board had upheld the district's anti-gang policy and told 11th grader Ryan Green that the necklace wasn't allowed. Green's parents asked to overturn the policy. The board president says panel members realized that freedom of religion was more important than the district's safety concerns. Members of more than 40 religious groups have gathered in Colorado Springs, Colorado, in a conservative city, really, to brainstorm how to win more acceptance of gays within the religious community. The National Religious Leadership Roundtable includes Muslims, Jews, Catholics, Quakers, Methodists, Lutherans, and Mennonites. They're brought together by the Policy Institute of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force to try to forge a common front against religious-based anti-gay and lesbian activism. You're listening to Democracy Now! Well, to our first story of the day, having to do with Indonesia and our very own Amy Goodman. Just days before East Timor's historic vote on self-determination, Indonesia yesterday deported Democracy Now! Host Amy as she tried to enter the country to cover that referendum. When Amy arrived at Bali's International Ngurah Rai Airport, customs officials said she was on a computer blacklist and would be deported immediately. She was put on the next plane to Taipei. As regular listeners of Democracy Now! May know, Amy has exposed atrocities committed by the Indonesian government in East Timor all the way during its 27-year occupation of the territory. In November of 1991, she survived the Santa Cruz massacre in Dili, in which Indonesian soldiers with U.S.-issued M16 rifles opened fire on a crowd of peaceful Timorese protesters, killing at least 250 of them. Amy was beaten by the military, and after reporting the massacre to the outside world, the Indonesian government banned her from that country. She subsequently told the story of the massacre in a documentary called Massacre, the Story of East Timor. Speaking to us from a hotel room in Taipei after having been deported, we have with us on the line Amy Goodman. Amy, are you there?
It's great to be with you, Laura.
Tell us, in your own words, exactly what happened as you arrived at the airport.
Well, I went to Bali's international airport, flew in from New York, from John F. Kennedy Airport. And there is a standard waited in the customs line. And when the customs official took my passport and typed it into the computer, he said that my name came up on the blacklist. And he brought me across the immigration area where he was telling other immigration officials that I was blacklisted, and they brought me into a room and took out several bound books, and they showed me that on page 30, my name was listed. They also brought the computer. They also showed me the computer blacklist with my name on it, and I asked who had officially barred me from entering the country, and they said it's the Ministry of Defense. It's the military who has given the order. I demanded to speak to someone higher up for further explanation about why I would be banned, and they refused, and they put me on a plane to Taiwan, which is unfortunately where I am right now.
What was your expectation as you approached the customs line, as it were? It's clear that you have a record there, that you're known, but on the other hand, the impression being given to the world by the Habibie government is that things have changed.
That's right, Laura. Yes, we do know that there is a blacklist that's maintained of thousands of names of people who cannot enter Indonesia for all sorts of reasons, and not just journalists, but in case of journalists, those who've exposed the corruption of the military and the Suharto regime, those that have exposed atrocities. Now, as you said, I survived the massacre in 91 in East Timor. I was there with reporter Alan Nairn. And when we reported this story to the outside world, the Indonesian military held two news conferences announcing that we would not be allowed back into Indonesia or East Timor, saying we were a threat to national security. But in 1994, when President Clinton went to Indonesia to meet with then-dictator Suharto, it also turns out later we've learned he was going there also to meet with his campaign contributors. He was there for the APEC summit, the Asia-Pacific Leaders Summit that took place in 94. Indonesia lifted the ban so that we could enter the country, and this was under Suharto. When we attempted to get into East Timor, then we were arrested, but we eventually did get back in to East Timor and were able to interview the Bishop Bello, who eventually won the Nobel Peace Prize, and spoke with a resistance leader there who told us at the time in East Timor the torture most commonly used was electroshock to the genitals and forcing the Timorese to swallow their crucifixes. That was 1994. It's now 5 years later, and there is supposedly a new regime in place, as you said, B.J. Habibie. But clearly, it's the military that's in power, as the military, at least in my case, maintains this blacklist. I didn't know what would happen. They don't talk about the blacklist. You don't know if your name remains on it unless you go and you find out, like I found out. I'm the only reporter to be prevented from going into East Timor right now to cover events leading up to the historic self-determination referendum that's taking place on August 30th. And I think the military should be stopping the violence, stopping the support of paramilitaries there, stopping their own militaries from terrorizing the population, rather than banning journalists.
How do you know that you're the only journalist that's been banned?
I don't know that I am not the only journalist that has been banned from Indonesia in general, but at this point, I'm the only one who's been deported as I attempted to get in to cover the East Timor referendum.
So do you have concerns about the type of coverage that we'll be getting of this upcoming vote if people like yourself with a history may be deported or may be forbidden from getting access?
Well, fortunately, there are a number of journalists there, and perhaps more importantly, because we know how some of the corporate press can be, there are hundreds of, more than 1,000 observers, people from around the world who are in East Timor right now, who are in the 13 different districts and the hundreds of polling places, and they are watching. Ian Martin, the head of the UNIMET mission, which is running the referendum, UNIMET stands for United Nations Assistance Mission in East Timor, has said that he wants the paramilitaries, these are death squads that are acting as proxies for the Indonesian military, that he wants those that are outside their containment areas that are carrying guns to be arrested. Also wants military, high-level military, the Indonesian military, who is going along with paramilitary activity, either engaging in it with them or allowing it to take place, wants these military and police to be removed. Basically, has called for the prosecution of those who are attacking civilians. What observers and some journalists are doing are starting to name names of the military and paramilitary who are engaging in these attacks. And this is what's absolutely critical, and I assume this is what the Indonesian military does not want.
Well, we're going to go to one of those observers now, Amy. We have with us one of those who is in the region right now as a member of one of the largest observer projects in East Timor. It's Joe Nevins with the International Federation for East Timor Observer Project. Joe, tell us a little bit about what you're doing. We understand that there are reports of increased violence by Indonesian armed militias against pro-independence Timorese, but there have also been threats directed to groups like yours, as I understand it. Joe Nevins.
That's right. The IFED Observer Project has teams in 13 different areas of East Timor currently, and from all our teams, we're getting reports of increased violence as the date of the August 30th vote approaches. There have been a number of house burnings in different areas where paramilitary groups backed up by the Indonesian military are terrorizing the local population as a way of undermining support for the pro-independence option. There have been a number of shootings and killings over the last week, and there have even been UNIMET is the United Nations mission here in East Timor. There have even been attacks against UNIMET officials. Just yesterday, three-person team of us in the town of Ailao was stopped at a roadblock manned by a few dozen paramilitary members who were armed with machetes and a submachine gun. There were Indonesian police present at the roadblock. It's important to remember, under the UN accord that is allowing this vote to take place, Indonesian police and military are responsible for security. They were stopped at this paramilitary roadblock. They were threatened with the local Kepala Desa, the local administrator, an Indonesian government official, was present at the roadblock and threatened to shoot the IFET OP observers. He did this in front of Indonesian police and UN officials. The police did nothing to arrest this man. So if these threats are taking place against international observers, you can imagine what's going on in terms of the East Timorese population.
Well, let me understand this better, Joe Nevins. Organizations like yours and people who are actually with the UN observer mission presumably have been assured some kind of security by the UN who invited people to come. What do you think of the UN's guarantees at this point of safety, not just obviously for you all, but for the Timorese?
Well, the UN's security mandate for this mission in East Timor is extremely weak. Basically, the UN security personnel play an advisory role here. They have no arrest powers. They're completely unarmed. So security is completely in the hands of the Indonesian security apparatus. And what the UN is basically relying on is the goodwill of the Indonesian security apparatus, which, of course, is in extremely short supply. Vis-a-vis the East Timorese population, there is an incredible climate of fear as the vote approaches. Indonesian military personnel and paramilitary groups have been making threats of a pending bloodbath if the pro-independence option wins. And as Bishop Bello of East Timor wrote in the New York Times today, there's no question that the majority of the people here in East Timor support the independence option. It's for that reason that the Indonesian military and its allies have to engage in terror to undermine the vote. This is why it's all the more important that international observer groups like ourselves and people in places like the United States put increasing pressure on the United States government so they can pressure the Indonesian government, with which they've long been allied, to respect the will of the people here in East Timor.
Well, let's talk about that, Joe Nevins, and then with Amy Goodman, whom I believe is still on the line. You mentioned the editorial in today's New York Times by Carlos Bello, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Dili, who received a Nobel Peace Prize in 96. He calls on Washington, who, as he said, has backed the Indonesian generals for a long time, to make it clear to Indonesia that no more military assistance or loans will come unless the army ends the violence and that a peaceful vote takes place. What do you think indeed could be done in terms of applying pressure to the U.S. and by the U.S.? First, Joe, and then Amy.
Well, up until this point, what's largely happened in terms of the U.S. position is threats, saying if the vote is undermined, perhaps U.S. financial assistance to Indonesia will be cut off. I think rather than just issuing threats, the aid has to be cut off immediately until the vote actually takes place. And we know that the Indonesians are going to respect the outcome of the vote. I think there also needs to be serious efforts to greatly increase the United Nations security mandate, and that can only happen with the active support of the United Nations ruling powers, most significantly the United States.
Amy Goodman,
that
do you have some...
To, hopefully...
Amy Goodman, can you come in on the U.S. role here?
Yes, which has been very significant over the years from 1975 when Indonesia invaded and 90% of the weapons used were from the United States. As Joe was saying, we're not only looking at the August 30th referendum, but the period right afterwards where some of the paramilitaries have promised a bloodbath if the vote goes for independence. And this is an absolutely critical period as the UN counts up the vote, and then afterwards, once the vote is then enforced over the months. A high-level congressional delegation just went to East Timor, and they saw the level and heard about the level of violence. That was Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the Democrat, Tom Harkin of Iowa, the Democrat, as well as Congressmember Jim McGovern of Massachusetts. But I think there also has to be a high-level U.S. administration delegation there to show seriousness, and then dealing with legislation that is put forward that cuts off all loopholes for military training and military aid. It's something that activists in the United States and church groups have pushed for legislation, and that clearly has to continue, not only for the people of East Timor, who continue to be under the thumb of the Indonesian military until the day that they are freed from that, and possibly that will come from this referendum, but also for the people of Indonesia, the fourth largest country in the world, who have succeeded in ousting the former dictator Suharto, but still face the power of an unbroken military in Indonesia.
Joan Nevins, before we close, remind us a little bit about the work of your organization and others like it that are doing the observer missions right now. What do you think will be your authority or power to do what Amy was discussing about naming names and so on? What will you be trying to do in the next few days?
Well, we see one of our primary functions is trying to publicize the human rights situation here in East Timor as it relates to the consultation, and through that to facilitate public pressure on the Indonesian government to respect the will of the people. At the same time, we play a role by engaging in what we call public accompaniment. By being present in the streets and villages of East Timor, we hopefully minimize the space that those who are trying to violently undermine the UN process, specifically the Indonesian military and the militias, we try to minimize the space for them to act by having a high level of visibility.
And Amy Goodman, what are your plans at this point?
Well, I've been banned from Indonesia, so we will just continue to cover events as you're doing right now, Laura, keep talking to people on the ground in Dili and around East Timor as we lead up to the historic August 30th vote. I should say something else. There is someone who is trying to get into East Timor who has international support, has really raised a level of outcry around the world, a doctor from Iowa named Dr. Dan Murphy, who has been doggedly working at the Motayal Clinic in Dili for many months now, treating the wounded and the sick, the people who have been hurt by the paramilitaries that have been very active in East Timor. And this doctor has now been barred from re-entering East Timor, and I know he'll be holding a news conference in Washington, D.C. with José Ramos Horta, the other winner of the Nobel Peace Prize with Bishop Bello, on August 30th, the day of the referendum. There will also be vigils around the country on August 30th. That begins Sunday night in the United States because of the time difference as people look what happens on this day of this historic vote. But it is critical that the U.S. assert its muscle. It is the leading superpower behind Indonesia in putting pressure on the Indonesian regime for the military not to conduct the kind of terror campaign that it has conducted in East Timor.
Amy Goodman, thank you very much. Familiar voice to Democracy Now! Listeners. Democracy Now!'s host, Amy Goodman, will be back with you soon, it sounds like. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy here on Democracy Now! We've been speaking, in addition, with Joe Nevins, who is currently in East Timor, taking part in one of the election observer missions. Stay tuned. We'll take a break for 60 seconds and be right back with you. You are listening to Democracy Now! My name is Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman until she returns from Indonesia. We are going to talk about another country now that has been a primary recipient of U.S. aid, including military aid. That is Colombia. The Clinton administration says it is currently preparing to increase military and economic aid to that country, saying that Colombia's guerrillas are enriching themselves with drug money and have become a threat to the so-called war on drugs. In separate visits to Colombia in the last few weeks, senior U.S. officials have been warning Colombian President Andrés Pestana that he risks losing U.S. support if he makes further compromises with the rebels, a strategy that the Colombian government had been using in its peace negotiations. Instead, the U.S. government has offered the Colombian government of Pestana a sharp increase in military and economic aid if it strengthens the military and puts more efforts and resources into the drug war. Critics say that will lead to a military that has been closely linked to paramilitary death squads getting even more opportunity to commit human rights violations. They also dispute the term narco-guerrilla, which has been used by the U.S. government to justify this increase in military aid to Colombia. With us on the line from Bogota is Steve Dudley, who's a freelance journalist and reporter based in Colombia. Steve, what do you know of the missions that have taken place in the last few weeks, including one by Colonel Pickering from the State Department and also more recently by Bill McCaffrey of the so-called drug war, the drug czar? What do you understand to be on the table right now?
Well, Laura, from what I understand, at least ostensibly, the visits were for informational purposes. They were supposedly so the government of the United States could obtain the latest on the strategy here in Colombia towards the Colombian rebels. The other thing that was definitely talked about was aid and how that aid would be administered and what type of aid that would be. And that aid is going to be dependent upon what appears to be a coherent strategy on the part of the Colombian government. And up until this point, the Colombian government has had everything but a coherent strategy.
One of the questions that's been raised here in the press is that the economic aid we're talking about is in the realm of hundreds of millions of dollars, and that the Colombian defense officials have requested a $500 million addition to their military aid over the next 2 years, something that U.S. officials are apparently discussing. Is this the kind of sums that we're talking about?
I don't think there's any question those are the types of sums that we're talking about. This year, the Colombian government received around $256 million, according to General Barry McCaffrey, who's the drug czar in the United States. And in the future, we're looking at similar sums. I think maybe even slight increases. I don't expect to see tremendous increases, but I think we'll see a pretty steady flow of around $300 million a year coming into Colombia. The important fact here to keep in mind is that a lot of this aid will probably start to go to the Colombian military. And as you pointed out already, the Colombian military has been linked with right-wing paramilitaries here and who commit two-thirds of the human rights abuses in this country. So this policy could lead to perhaps an increase in human rights abuses. However, the United States government says they have a very strict screening policy, so that all the aid that goes to the Colombian military will go to units that do not have any human rights abusers in them. How much we can really trust in this sort of screening process is subject to debate, I think.
Well, we're going to have a bit of discussion about that just now with Charlie Roberts from the Colombian Human Rights Committee. Charlie has been following the situation in Colombia for many years. The Colombian Human Rights Committee is based in Washington, D.C. Charlie, what do you make of what it looks like an increase in U.S. Military aid in the name of combating guerrillas? It seems like an old argument immediately following a situation in which it looked as if there was a move towards negotiations and peace accords.
The peace process was the main promise made by both of the candidates in last year's elections in Colombia, that they would seriously pursue a peace process. The vast majority of people in Colombia have come to the conclusion that more war is not the way to bring about peace to what's been a 40 to 50 year long internal armed conflict. And in saying, by the United States saying, that it's going to deal with drug trafficking problems and drug problems by providing greater aid to fight the guerrillas, it does a disservice to any whatever the U.S. drug policy goals are, because it fundamentally misunderstands the dynamics of the drug industry in Colombia, and it misunderstands the nature of the political war. In doing so, the United States is following a long tradition of trying to impose its own schemes on other countries. In particular, they say that the guerrilla forces are narco-traffickers. One need not be a supporter of the guerrillas to recognize that the areas of guerrilla dominance in the southern part of Colombia that have seen a skyrocketing coca leaf production in recent years, it's not that the guerrillas are being paid by drug barons to watch over coca fields. Rather, because of the extreme poverty that's at the core of the armed, at the basis of the armed conflict, peasants who've been thrown off their lands elsewhere have tended, as they have for generations, to migrate to wherever there might be some kind of an income to be made. So most of the people actually involved in cultivating the coca leaf are simply people trying to eke out a subsistence the only way they can, having been thrown off of lands in other parts with concentration of land holdings, for example, in the Andean region.
What about the question of U.S. policy in light of the, well, really in light of the recent situation in Kosovo, where you have a not incomparable situation, I would suggest, of government authorities pursuing a minority and increasing conflict with a neighboring state, namely Venezuela? In this case, obviously, the decision on which side to come down appears to have been made and to be a different one than the one in the Yugoslav situation. But do you see any parallels there or any questions that should be asked? Charlie Roberts?
Well, the main issue for those of us in the United States is what is the role of the United States going to be? You've got a serious humanitarian problem of 1.3 million people displaced. It's not received sufficient attention by policymakers. It's Colombia is now the third largest recipient of military aid after Israel and Egypt, and the Washington Post has reported that only last week did President Clinton here get a briefing on the Colombian situation for the first time in apparently in his several years of being president. It's important to look at the players and to be critical of looking at who are the people coordinating U.S. policy to Colombia at this time and what are the serious mistakes they're making, in particular in undermining a Colombian policy, which is a political decision in Colombia to pursue a peace process with the guerrillas. Ambassador Pickering from the State Department was ambassador to El Salvador in the early 1980s. He's serving at this point. Really, the interests in Colombia that are going to receive aid are minority interests and interests very much bound up with the armed conflict, particularly the army and the national police. A point that's seldom made is that under Colombian legislation, Colombian military officers receive double pay during emergency or war-type situations, which means they have a direct self-interest in doing what they've been doing for the last 35 years, which is to indefinitely drag out the armed conflict and to tend to undermine whatever peace initiatives come forth from the civilian side of the government. General McCaffrey has been head of the U.S. Southern Command formerly in Panama, and he has said that the drug war is a 20 to 25-year crusade, which means there are no clear policy goals to be set, although he's not reluctant to move in militarily. And yes, the extension of the armed conflict does seem to have spillover insofar as there are guerrilla forces fighting in some cases along Colombian borders with other countries. This is an issue in and of itself where the U.S. has been trying to get the other countries to bow to U.S. dictates, particularly letting, as I say, the military interests prevail and the military alliances prevail, and really not only paying scant attention to the forces that are calling for peace, but really working against the majority of Colombians who 2 years ago voted, 10 million people, more than voted for any single candidate, voted for a peace referendum. And what President Pastrana has been doing has been to try to pursue a peace process. It's been very difficult. It's certainly a very challenging situation. And what remains to be seen at this point is whether Pastrana will bow to the U.S. pressure to step up and continue to give special privileges and situation in which a blind eye is turned to the majority of human rights abuses committed by the Colombian armed forces and their paramilitary allies.
That's Charlie Roberts from the Columbia Human Rights Committee. Stay on the line if you would, Charlie. I'd like to go back to Steve Dudley for just a moment. Steve Dudley, you're doing regular reporting from Bogota, and one thing I would ask you to clarify for our listeners is how distinct or different is this moment in time? Some may think, well, haven't the U.S. military been funding Colombia to one or other extent for decades? What is different about right now, and what is different on the ground?
Well, I think Charlie very aptly pointed out the difference, that the Colombian government is mightily pursuing a peace process. And what is the best way to pursue a peace process? Well, some would say to that the United States, for example, in this case, the war we're talking about right now, needs to support what is the negotiation process rather than the process of escalating the war. So the difference is that at this point in time, Colombians, on the first hand, they feel the war a lot more. The war seems a lot closer to their doorstep. There's many more battles. There are many more massacres. Things are happening closer to the capital city of Bogota. Things are happening more closer to the other capital cities of other states, Colombia. So people are in the vein of looking for peace and trying mightily to support Pastrana and his President Pastrana and his peace efforts, and so the difference really is that there is a need and a want for peace, and so for the United States to pursue a policy which at its core is essentially aimed at weakening the guerrillas and forcing them to the negotiating table, it seems a little bit strange, I think, to Colombians, to many analysts, really, not just Colombian analysts, but also U.S. analysts and European analysts who I've spoken to recently.
The decision to escalate the aid this month comes a year after the U.S. resumed helping the army, as they put it, and expanding intelligence sharing, after a period during much of the decade in which overt collaboration, at least, had been cut off because of the Army's human rights record. To come back to you, Charlie Roberts, this sort of playing with money and intelligence, offering loans, withdrawing loans, threatening to withdraw them, do you think there is a role for U.S. government pressure in this way if it were to be accurately applied?
I think the only kind of U.S. pressure that, or certainly the main thrust of U.S. pressure at this time, if it's to be helpful, to help bring about a more stable and peaceful situation in Colombia, would be to figure out how, as in some cases the U.S. has done elsewhere at certain points in time, how the U.S. could bring pressure to bear to give incentives to the two sides to move forward in the peace process. What the United States is doing by offering military intelligence sharing is just the opposite. It's facilitating continued offensive actions by different of the armed actors. It's important to realize that the vast majority of Colombians are very tired of this war, and have definitely seen a need for some kind of negotiation process, some kind of political resolution. And at this point, U.S. military intelligence sharing is a very bad policy insofar as it means the U.S. is working most closely with minority sectors that have no accountability, namely Army and police as well. The police, it's important to remember, in Colombia are actually part of the military. They're part of the Ministry of Defense.
Charlie Roberts, one more last question about what your activities and the activities of your organization are here in the United States and what people can or could do if they wanted to find out more information and get more involved in this.
Well, we will be the Columbia Human Rights Committee, together with other committees that are part of the Columbia Human Rights Network, will be sponsoring a national tour this fall from September 23rd to November 4th of indigenous leader Eulalia Yagari, who is from the Organización Indígena de Antioquia, which is the Antioquia region indigenous organization, who will describe the various problems that the indigenous people of Colombia are facing, in particular in the ongoing armed conflict. Also, she is from a people who are threatened by expanding hydroelectric projects, which in turn are tied into the expansion of paramilitary power in her home state of Antioquia. And we'll also be sponsoring conferences. Different member groups of the committee will be having conferences in that period, in September and October, especially an October 15th conference here in Washington. And that will be under the aegis of our project, the U.S.-Colombia Coordinating Office, And anyone interested should please contact the U.S. Columbia Coordinating Office at telephone 202-232-8090. That's based here in Washington. And or visit our webpage at www.igc.org/COLHRNET.
Thanks, Charlie. Charlie Roberts is with the Columbia Human Rights Committee, a Washington-based human rights organization. The number he just gave out was 202-232-8090, and we'll have more contact information on the Pacifica Democracy Now! Website. Thank you, Charlie Roberts and Steve Dudley from Bogota. We'll be back with you here on Democracy Now! In 60 seconds. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as Amy Goodman would say. Sitting in for Amy, I'm Laura Flanders, and we're going to turn now to Turkey. The death toll for last week's devastating earthquake there continues to climb. It's now officially at 18,000 dead and thousands more feared buried under the rubble. Some officials say the final count could be as high as 40,000. It was a week today that the earthquake struck, and Turks have criticized their government for its inadequate response in many ways. Two sectors in Turkey are particularly blamed for the tragedy and its chaotic, tragic aftermath. Turkish builders and contractors who erected shoddy structures that easily caved in and turned into death traps, and the Turkish army, too, which stood idly by for days before it joined the rescue efforts over the weekend. Several Turkish builders apparently fled the country immediately following the earthquake, anticipating the furious response of victims. And with an annual budget of billions of dollars from the U.S. and European military aid, too, the Turkish military has stood out for its inaction in the relief effort. One person who has raised some questions about both the record of the military and the contractors and also the coverage of these two situations is Robert Fisk. He is Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper of London. He was in Istanbul after the earthquake, but joins us now from Beirut. Robert Fisk, on the question of the contractor's fault in this tragedy, what did you find in Istanbul?
Well, I suppose I can put it most bleakly and most accurately by describing the actions of a middle-aged woman whose brother and whose father died in Yalova in a building which collapsed, seven-story building which collapsed in the very center of the city. Right in front of me, she picked up a piece of concrete, which was part of the original building, and she smashed it at our feet, and it ricocheted into several pieces. And she handed me the result, which was a piece of concrete which literally crumbled in my hand. What everyone said, and which is undoubtedly and sadly true, is that the businessmen who constructed these apartments, often as luxury apartments beside the Sea of Marmara, this area, for example, which I'm talking about, Yalova, was a resort area outside Istanbul, which you reached on a catamaran at an hour's sailing. It was a very luxury area. And what she was showing me was an area which had been effectively constructed by developers who had used very cheap methods of building apartments. You know, when you build an apartment block anywhere in the world, you use concrete. And to make concrete, you have to use sand and cement. And these people used too much sand, which is very cheap, and too little cement, which is very expensive. The result was that instead of building a secure structure, the developers built apartment blocks, which were, in effect, houses of sand. They were almost 70% sand.
And does the response...
when the earthquake came, they came down. And much worse than this, after originally seeking building permission for three-story buildings, which they obtained, they then built four or five more blocks on top. In other words, we ended up with an eight-story building, an eight-floor building.
So the responsibility for this kind of tragedy, Robert Fisk, the responsibility for this, does it lie solely in the hands of the contractors, or are you suggesting there was a government role in failing, as you just suggested, to enforce regulations?
Well, certainly in the case of Yalova, many local people are saying that because the contractors and the developers had direct relations, in one case a family relation, with the local member of parliament, that there was clearly, between the contractors and the government, an understanding that these buildings would go up even if they breached the regulations, not just of local authority dimensions for a building, but of course of earthquake standards as well. So when the earthquake came, these buildings came down inevitably and irretrievably. So there is undoubtedly a very serious culpability in the hands of the construction engineers, of the builders, and indeed, as you rightly said in the introduction to this talk, a number of senior members of the development community in Turkey did flee. One of them, of whom 550 out of 600 buildings collapsed, actually fled on a Lufthansa flight to Germany within hours of the earthquake. And indeed, a member of his family, who is said to be the local MP, and indeed one of the other relatives, or at least assistants to the construction company and mayor, could not be seen in the town in the aftermath of this disaster to Yalova. I'm talking about this area, which is a resort area outside Istanbul on the other side of the Sea of Marmara.
The other people who were notably absent, particularly in the first days of the relief effort, were the Turkish army. Military teams could make it from Switzerland and France and Austria, but somehow the Turkish military, with its very large budget of $4.5 billion, boosted by U.S. contributions, had not performed the function that people might have expected. What have you uncovered about exactly what was holding them back, or what were they doing, and what is the size of the Turkish military at this point?
Well, we're talking here about one of the largest military forces in the Middle East, an army which has more than 500 fighter bombers, more than 4,200 tanks, Apache attack helicopters, an army which, after all, occupies northern Cyprus, which is fighting with 250,000 men, Kurdish insurgents in southeastern Turkey, which has burned more than 1,000 villages outside Diyarbakir, which has participated in the NATO bombardment of Yugoslavia. This army proved itself, as we saw with our own eyes, to be pitiful when confronted with this massive earthquake in northwestern Turkey. You know, one of the interesting things is that when we first arrived at the earthquake scene, there were a few soldiers armed with automatic rifles, not with spades, picks and shovels, but with rifles. When within 36 hours I reached the city of Izmit with perhaps 20,000 dead, the army were driving around in armored personnel carriers as if they were expecting an insurrection rather than trying to rescue their own people. And it quickly became apparent that this bloated, pampered army didn't have a single earthquake rescue brigade, not a brigade, not even a company, not even a platoon. It didn't have any sniffer dogs. This was an army which had been encouraged by NATO and by the United States to fight wars against Turkey's enemies. But when Turkey was confronted by its greatest enemy, the earthquakes of the North Anatolian fault line, it could do nothing. It was pathetic in its response. In 2 days after the earthquake in the town of Yalova, which perhaps had, certainly had at least 10,000 dead buried in the rubble, a convoy arrived, and the soldiers, again equipped with rifles, not picks and shovels, but rifles, simply sat in their convoy in the center of the city while neighbors and civilians scrabbled with their fingers into the rubble to try and rescue their neighbors. What we saw, in effect, was an army which was more than capable of attacking its neighbors, perhaps on the West's behalf, but totally incapable of rescuing and helping its own people. And remember that in Turkey, the army is a very revered institution. This is the army of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. It is regarded as an institution which is the defender of the Turkish people. Any journalist in Turkey who criticizes the Turkish army is either put on trial or thrown into prison, and in some cases tortured.
We're going to go to that very topic next.
Yeah, go on.
Robert Fisk, we're going to go to that topic next. If we can hold you on the line, I'd like to bring into this discussion Jill Newsham, who is a Turkey researcher for Index on Censorship, which is a bi-monthly British publication, mm-hmm. and regularly talks about the suppression of free speech in Turkey and the treatment of journalists. Jill, the point that Robert Fisk is making is that it's been hard, at least we can say hard, for journalists to raise criticisms of the military and the government. What has that contributed to the current situation, and what do you know now of the state of journalists who try to raise these questions?
Yeah, well, there's a history of the way that journalism operates within Turkey, which is similar to after this tragedy, is that journalists do speak out. There is an outrage in the press, there's an uproar as reflecting what's happening in the public sphere, and then the authorities clamp down, either gently or with more force. And I've not been in Turkey myself at this time, but following the press, there are one or two lone voices speaking out, but they tend to be in the English language Turkish press. And you can see in the variety of the Turkish press that there's a softening now, and there's particularly, rather than blaming the government and blaming the authorities, as most people seem to be doing in Turkey, the press is now moving more to targeting specifically contractors, even naming and shaming specific ones, which I think is very dangerous in this emotional atmosphere in Turkey now.
When you talk about the suppression of journalists in countries, sometimes it's unclear exactly what form that takes. Can you tell us something of the history that you know of what has happened to journalists in the past who've spoken out?
Well, certainly, according to an Article 19 report last year, the Human Rights Organization, they say that more than half of the journalists in jail worldwide are in Turkish prisons. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. Papers are constantly closed down. Often I've heard that there's a free press, a lively free press in Turkey. But I would say the only free press in Turkey is that which avoids subjects deemed taboo by the government. Most of the Turkish press is sensationalist. Largely they say the same thing. And then there's the oppositionist press, mostly left-wing, often pro-Kurdish, and that's highly repressed.
When you talk about highly repressed, what kind of thing happens to journalists that do step from, out of line?
From the very clear examples of censorship, from newspapers being confiscated, being banned, being taken off the streets, to journalists being arrested, harassed, and even murdered.
To come back to you, Robert Fisk, the situation that we're seeing in Turkey now coincides exactly with what we're understanding to be actually an escalation of the U.S., British, and Turkish enforcement, as they put it, of the so-called no-fly zones in Iraq. Do you see a connection there?
Well, I think it's too early to make any kind of comparisons or any kind of parallels. It is, however, instructive, I think, that in the hours that immediately followed the earthquake, General Hussein Kılıçkoğlu, who is the chief of the Turkish general staff of the army, took time off to visit the tomb of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the Turkish nation, with an important guest. He took there his American opposite number, General Henry H. Shelton. Now, you would have thought within hours of this devastating earthquake, with perhaps 50,000 dead, that the Turkish general could have taken General Shelton to the scenes of devastation. After all, the Americans later offered their assistance with ships and clinics and hospitals. But they went off to Atatürk's tomb and then went into conclave with the U.S. ambassador and other American military officers at army headquarters, and then gave a press conference during which General Shelton, while sharing, as he put it, the sorrow of the Turkish people, went on to defend U.S. bombing policy in Iraq. It was almost as if the Americans were more interested in destroying the Iraqi regime than they were in this catastrophe which had befallen their great ally. We had Mr. Clinton, President Clinton, saying that Turkey is our long-term ally and the people of Turkey are our friends, but the American army were conspicuous by their absence in the first days after this cataclysm hit the Turkish people. And the Turkish army, barring a few commandos who did dig bravely into the rubble with their own hands, and barring the arrival of a few troop convoys, were absent. The defenders of Turkey, who are, of course, supported by NATO and indeed armed by NATO, their response was pathetic. And, you know, the real problem is that we have nurtured the Turkish army as a gendarme, as a policeman of the Middle East, but we never encouraged them in human rights in the Kurdish areas, and we never encouraged them to protect their own people, only to attack our enemies, which might also be conceived of as their enemies. So you had this massive army, I mean, a quarter of a million soldiers fighting an insurgent war in southeast Turkey. Imagine if they could have been mobilized and sent within 24 hours to northwest Turkey, hundreds, perhaps thousands of ordinary Turkish civilians, their own people, would have been dragged and rescued from the ruins. But instead of that, the Turkish army remained an army which effectively was defending NATO's enemies, and it was the ordinary people, neighbors, relatives, sometimes the civil defense units, sometimes, very often, overseas armies like the Austrians and particularly the French in Yalova, whom I saw crawling into mud galleys which they'd made with their own spades, using pit props, wooden pit props to climb in, who were rescuing people, while the Turkish army strode around the streets with weapons as if they were about to defend themselves from some kind of revolution. Mm. It was a truly pitiful sight. And one of the great problems, I mean, let me go back to our colleague from Index on Censorship. Anyone who reads Index regularly will see that the largest section on the intimidation of journalists is not Iraq, is not Syria, is not Israel. It is almost invariably Turkey. And yet here is a country which is nurtured by us, which wants to join the European Union, which the European Union actually would like to have as a member, if it would just clean up its human rights a little bit, which could not and did not and totally failed its own people. It didn't help its own people.
Robert Fisk, and one last point. We talked earlier in the program about drug trading, and I think that there's also been a history of allegations regarding that particular activity and the Turkish administration. A final note on that question? We've got like 30 seconds.
Well, I can do less than 30 seconds. I'm not an expert on drug trading in Turkey. Geographically, Turkey is in a position where it is one of the powers of drugs traders into Europe. But I don't think that's the point. The point is that it has a pampered army which we, the West, and particularly America, support. And when it came to saving its own people from an earthquake, it totally failed to do so. And the question is why. We didn't bother to train them in human rights. We weren't interested in training them in earthquake rescue. We wanted them to be an offensive force. And indeed they are, which is why they failed their own people.
Robert Fisk, thank you very much for being with us here on Democracy Now! Robert Fisk is the Middle East correspondent for the London newspaper The Independent. With us also has been Jill Newsham, who is the Turkey researcher for Index on Censorship, which is a bi-monthly British publication out of London. That does it for today's program. For a copy of today's show, please call the following toll-free number. It's 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also find Democracy Now! On the Pacifica website at www.pacifica.org. Today's program has been produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Bernard White engineered the program today. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!